to sing this song for the healing of the world.
Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. Like so many witnessing the immense suffering in Gaza, Cassandra Dixon wanted to do something to help the situation. Cassandra has made numerous visits to Palestine and has come to know many people there as personal friends, so she strongly felt the call to join the Freedom Flotilla to Gaza, carrying thousands of tons of humanitarian aid for the starving people there. At home in Madison, Wisconsin area, Cassandra does carpentry and home repair, leaving herself the time and freedom to annually spend a month or more in Palestine. Still, Cassandra needs and deserves our support, including through the GoFundMe to support Cassandra's participation in the flotilla. Cassandra is active with the Madison Rafah Sister City Project and is a supporter of Palestine Partners, supporting women in the Hebron Craft Cooperative. One of the projects being advanced and fundraised by the Madison Rafah Sister City Project is the fundraiser for the Middle East Children's Alliance. At the time that this interview with Cassandra Dixon was recorded, Cassandra was just a few hours from her departure from Madison, and the flotilla has since docked in Turkey, poised to continue on to Gaza. Right now, we join Cassandra Dixon just hours before her departure for the Freedom Flotilla. Cassandra, thanks so much for joining me for Spirit in Action.
Happy to be here.
I'm especially appreciative because I do know that you're taking off in just a couple hours. Get ready to depart for the flotilla. Could you tell our listeners for Spirit in Action a little bit about the flotilla?
Sure. So this is a civilian aid mission to Gaza. The flotilla will be carrying 5,500 tons of humanitarian aid, a lot of it food, and we hope to sail direct to Gaza in the coming week or so, depending on weather, coming days. Gaza is experiencing famine now, and this is a completely human-made situation brought about by the Israeli blockade of Gaza over many years, combined with the onslaught on Gaza since October 7th, and now the failure of Israel to allow aid trucks in over border crossings. Children are dying at a rate that's unconscionable, I think, for the world in 2024, and is completely preventable. So in light of the fact that this is ongoing, and despite there being tons and tons of aid sitting in trucks 10 minutes away from people who are starving, it's not getting through. So this flotilla is in response to that. It is completely civilian. And I think that that's because all of us on it feel that our governments are failing us in some ways, that this is not an undertaking that should have to be undertaken by random civilians. This is something that our larger entities should be doing, but that's not happening right now. So it's the level of horror that we feel that this starvation is happening now that's led people to participate in it.
Well, it is horrific, the images. I'm actually in touch with one person on the West Bank who's got refugees at her home from Gaza. And so I'm hearing about it in a fairly direct way. As a matter of fact, just a few weeks ago, I interviewed a woman from this area. I'm in Eau Claire, where she is at the moment, who was in Gaza 5 weeks ago helping out. And, you know, they had 40 people in the building where she was, and they could hear the bombing constantly. So on the ground, it's obviously horrendous. I understand that there have been several sources that have tried to get food into Gaza and other areas where the Palestinians are, and that they've been blocked, bombed, and so on. Is that something that is continuing to go? I mean, I understand that U.S. even was sending some aid and that are trying to drop it in and so on. Is that still happening too?
Yes, the airdrop is kind of an example of how convoluted this has become. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of trucks full of aid sitting at a closed border crossing. And the U.S. could easily prevail upon Israel to open that crossing and allow that aid in by land routes. It's only 10 minutes away from where it's needed, if it were to be allowed in. So the idea of building this complicated floating pier, which is contrary to the logic of getting aid in quickly. The airdrops have also been certainly problematic and inefficient way of delivering aid, and also a distraction from the fact that Israel is preventing the regular entry of aid. There have been Palestinians killed by the airdrops because stuff has landed on children instead of in any way that's usable. The amount of aid that's being dropped that way is minuscule in comparison to the need. A fair amount of it has landed in the ocean. So not to say that any aid is not needed. Obviously, if people are starving, then getting one meal ready to eat is better than nothing. But what this area needs now desperately is for all of the already coordinated aid that's sitting there waiting to get in, to be allowed in, and those organizations to be able to do what they do best, and which is distribute that aid. So UNICEF reported last week that they had a vehicle that was fired on with live ammunition, and they were trying to prevail on Israel to explain that, and they were getting no response. So again, this starvation is not happening for lack of willingness to deliver aid. This starvation is happening because that aid is being blocked. And the fact that the U.S. is engaging in these airdrops and the discussion of building some other floating port is largely a distraction from that. When we could, we have an enormous amount of power as the United States. We send to Israel in the normal course of events $8 million a day. And that's greatly elevated now since October. So we have a lot of bargaining power and could easily ask that our aid to Israel be conditioned on Israel allowing humanitarian aid into Gaza.
So some of the aid is just sitting there on the border waiting for permission for the trucks to go across the border. Some has been airdropped. What is the flotilla going to do that's different? That you've already been referring to it, but could you make it explicit? How will the flotilla get food in?
Well, it is a lot of aid. It's 5,500 tons of aid, so it's a substantial amount of aid. That's a lot more than one parachute at a time dropping. We saw horrific images of a pallet of aid having someone, but a lot of those aid packages being dropped are small. So this is actual aid, a substantial amount of it. It's not symbolic. And our hope is to sail directly to Gaza so that humanitarian organizations who are already there on the ground will be able to unload this aid and get it distributed. It's probably not as good as if those border crossings were to be opened and the aid that's already sitting there would be to allow it in. Obviously, if there are, I'm sure that you've seen images, you know, video and photos of these lines of trucks lined up there and people who are aid workers who are with those trucks posting videos just so frustrated that they're sitting there with food, trucks full of food, 10 minutes away from people who are starving. So I think that it's also possible that the fact of civilians making this trip, sailing when we are not necessarily boat people, right? Like just undertaking something that's way outside our own realms of comfort in order to try to move the world on this, to suggest that really the world needs to insist that Israel allow aid in the massive quantities that are needed.
I still think I'm probably missing just one little piece, but I think I've got it now. Instead of going by the routes, the roads, where a lot of the aid comes in, you're trying to make your own port into Gaza. Is that how the flotilla will work? That's what I think I've seen in the past when there have been flotilla efforts.
Right. We're hoping just to dock in Gaza and unload the aid.
I'm assuming that there's the danger that the Israelis won't allow that either. I suppose they could end up attacking you just as they did the World Central Kitchen folks.
It's certainly a possibility that Israel will refuse to allow the aid in. It's possible that they'll stop it in international waters. I personally am hoping that that doesn't happen. I'm hoping that a way opens, that there's some human response to this, or that there's enough pressure from the U.S., and that the aid will be allowed in, and that not just this aid, but that all aid will be allowed in.
I understand that this effort of the Freedom Flotilla actually extends back to something like 2010. There's been, because the blockade to keeping a whole bunch of materials out of Gaza dates back quite a ways. So are you aware, have you been part of, are you party to some of the knowledge on how the Freedom Flotilla has been formed in the past and what it's becoming now?
Right. The Freedom Flotilla has been part of a larger movement to challenge Israel's blockade of Gaza. So Gaza is an area about 25 miles long. At its widest point, it's 7 miles wide, and the majority of it is narrower than that. So it's a very small area. People are in Wisconsin listening to this. It would fit between Madison and Baraboo. It's tiny, and it is home to 2.2 million people, almost all of whom now have been displaced, and all of whom are facing food insecurity, and a large portion of whom are facing famine. The hunger situation is worse in the northern part of Gaza because people were forced out of there, and all of the infrastructure, nothing is working there. There's no, farms were destroyed, food manufacturing was destroyed. There's no access to food at all in northern Gaza. And a lot of those people have been displaced into southern Gaza, where clearly there was already an extremely densely populated, Gaza is one of the most densely populated places on earth, even when people are spread out throughout all of Gaza. So you can imagine if you force half of the population into the other half, how dense that is and how difficult it is for people to access food then. So the effort to challenge Israel's blockade on Gaza has been ongoing for a long time. Israel controls very tightly what comes in. They have stated in the past that their aim is to control food delivery so that people are living on a diet of about 1,100 calories a day, which clearly is not, certainly most Americans would have a fit at that. Other items that have been restricted from delivery include tampons, potato chips, rebar for construction, maternity kits, all kinds of medical aid. So over a long period of time, this is not just since October. So the civilian population of Gaza has been living without many things that we would consider essential human needs for a very long time. And the state of Israel, as an occupying power, actually has responsibility for the care of the people that they're occupying, for the human rights of those people. And that's been largely ignored for a long period of time. And the U.S. in particular, we have a history of kind of going along with that. And so I think that in this time for us as U.S. citizens to be challenging the way that our tax dollars are being spent is really important. This is tax season right now, right? We either just filed or we're scrambling to get an extension to file our taxes. This $8 million a day that the U.S. has been sending Israel for years and years and years is predominantly in military aid. Israel itself is a wealthy country and is not in need of humanitarian aid. So most of that aid that we provide is military aid. A lot of it is turned around and used to purchase weaponry from the U.S. But it leaves us in a situation where we own part of this problem, because our aid to Israel helps to create this situation. And our acceptance of the situation as a world power fails to challenge the abuse of human rights that's going on.
Is this a kind of a trip that you've done before, Cassandra?
No, I've never gone on, I've been on a canoe. That's about what I can say about my boat experience. I desperately hope that I don't become seriously seasick, and that if I do become seriously seasick, I desperately hope that I don't throw up on anyone.
Yeah. Well, that is courageous to take that on, because enough people are affected by that. But obviously, we're comparing seasickness with mass starvation. So I can understand that the motivation may be bigger. Why do you take it on as your personal responsibility to be part of this? And actually, the better question might be, why don't all the rest of us take it as our responsibility? That's a fair answer, by the way. But why is it for you?
I can't begin to answer for anyone else. But for myself, I think that why not would be my, like, why wouldn't I do this? I'm distraught beyond belief that we live in a world that apparently is willing to sanction the use of starvation as a weapon of war, especially when the people starving, the majority of them are children. This is not the world I want to live in. This is not the world I want for my children. This is not the world that I want for anyone. And yet, it's where we are. This is reality. And declining to look at that doesn't change the fact. I mean, yes, I could just not look at Instagram for a day and I would not see those images of those children. But that doesn't make them gone. That doesn't, I mean, there is no escaping the fact that this is our world today as we know it. And I think for all of our sakes, we desperately need to change that. We have to somehow or other embrace the concept of empathy and start to insist that our elected officials, that our governments, that our power structures operate with empathy as a goal. We are, all of us, not going to survive if we don't manage to do that.
Certainly the attack by Hamas into Israel, for a lot of Americans, I think, convinced them that, well, okay, it's okay what Israel does to react. Obviously, it's been disproportionate and horrendous, and I don't think it's justified. I was having a conversation about 3 weeks ago with some folks who are fundamentalist Christians, and they were completely supportive of what Israel was doing. And it was really hard to communicate to them why it's completely unjustified to attack 30,000 plus deaths of Palestinians. Have you had to face off with people who are attacking you for, like, you're supporting the enemy, some people, I think, mistakenly believe? Have you had to have those kind of conversations or face-offs?
It's really difficult to look at a two-year-old and see an enemy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't do that, and I honestly don't think anyone else can either. So if you choose that route, it's a construct. It takes an active choice and a lot of internal work to frame a two-year-old child as your own enemy.
I suspect that they would not argue that the two-year-old's their enemy, but that I think rationalizations I've heard is those two-year-olds are being used as shields to protect the really bad guys that are hiding behind them. Again, I think it's a rationalization, not a reason, but I try to understand how people can believe something that's so horrendously at odds with the way I see the world. And I'm just wondering if you've had to have those kind of conversations, or for all I know, you get, when I was protesting after we first went into Afghanistan back in 2001, I appeared on a local news program, and they asked me what should the U.S. done if we shouldn't have invaded. And I said, well, we should have looked at these reasons, alternatives, and this. And my wife got a call at our house the next day, someone saying, you tell him he should have gone up with the Twin Towers. And that kind of reaction is not unusual from people who are completely bought into an alternative story. Have you had to face those kind of things, Cassandra?
I mean, I guess I know that thinking is out there, but it's not a personal focus of mine. I think that we have to learn to engage in these things where we can, instead of trying to engage in them where it's impossible. So I am a U.S. citizen. I have absolutely no way of influencing what Hamas does or doesn't do. I have no contact with them. I have no, I'm not a citizen of a country where they exist. I have zero connection. However, with Israel, I have a lot. I am a citizen of the country that they consider a close ally. I'm a citizen of a country that underwrites an enormous amount of what they do, both financially and by publicly standing with them as a country. And that I can influence. So if we look at the situation now and we say multiple children are dying of hunger every single day, and we think that that's untenable, then this is where I can engage with that. My own tax dollars and my own culpability as a country that's supporting that. I guess that's my starting point. I think that we can change. I think that we can shift that. And we have enormous power. We have the power to learn. We have the power as people living in the U.S. to read a wide variety of news sources. We have the power to expand our thinking about the situation. We have the power to learn more about the last 75 years of occupation and the last 16 years of Israel's blockade on Gaza. We have the power to engage with people through social media. And like you mentioned, talking with a friend of yours who's been there recently and someone else who is in the West Bank hosting refugees. We have the power of making these connections. And then we have the power of speaking ourselves and engaging with conversations that, okay, maybe they start out a little bit uncomfortable. Maybe the person that you're talking to at first wants to clump you in with some terrifying group of people that are supporting something that they're scared of. But we have the power to keep talking, to work through that, and to share with our whoever it is that we're running into and having those conversations with that. These are human beings on the other end of this foreign policy. And this is not a sustainable foreign policy if it's resulting in this many deaths of children.
Way back in 1982, not too long after I got back from living in Africa, I was in the Peace Corps, I became a war tax resister. And considering that we've just passed tax day, when everybody's paying their federal taxes, and knowing that half of our federal tax goes to military, which includes this kind of military aid to other countries. For me, it became necessary starting back in 82 that I not contribute to that. Obviously, by taking your body as part of the Freedom Flotilla over to Gaza, you're using your body to help something good happen. Have you been working with people back here in Wisconsin where you live? Have you been working to try and remove those roots of the violence that we're transporting?
Yeah, I actually am fortunate to work in the city of Madison, which has had a relationship with the city of Rafah in Gaza for a long time. So they are an unofficial sister city and have been since 2003. So they have done a huge array of humanitarian projects, water filters, school programs, mental health programs, working with their partnered with Middle East Children's Alliance. And they're now involved with a fundraising effort to help Middle East Children's Alliance provide aid to Gaza. So Middle East Children's Alliance is one of those organizations that's inside Gaza now and doing their best to provide aid. And Madison Rafa has also done a lot of educational work around the issue of Palestine in Madison and throughout the state. We've brought speakers and hosted artistic programs and cultural events and all kind of, in an effort to help people in Wisconsin feel more connected to a part of the world that's a long ways away and often is suffering. Madison Rafa is a charity and so doesn't engage in politics, but there's also been a great opportunity recently in the primary to vote uninstructed, to send a message to our elected officials that support for this and a failure to demand an immediate and permanent ceasefire is problematic for us, to say the least, and that we want to be represented by elected officials that would take a stronger stand in support of humanity in Palestine. So I've visited my congressional offices a number of times with a number of different delegations, from delivering cards that were written by school children to going with the Madison Mennonite Church from Madison. And Madison Rothfuss had a long history of meeting with and trying to encourage elected officials to engage in this in a more human way, to visit themselves, to learn more about what's happening there, to move towards conditioning our funding of Israel to not abusing human rights there. So yes, there's many, many ways.
So many ways. My sense of you, and I only know of you a bit indirectly, Cassandra, there have been a few different people in the Madison Quaker meeting who have regularly posted information about the good work you're doing, the way you're putting your life on the line for the beliefs, the compassion that you share around the world. This is, again, just one element of your life. Have you gone out of the country to try and be peace activist in other areas or relief to other areas as well?
I would just have to add first that it's the people who are putting their lives on the line for human rights in Palestine are Palestinians who are caring for each other, who are struggling to stay safe and strong. There are many Palestinians going on this flotilla. For them, it's a much stronger risk than it is for me with my blue U.S. passport and my white skin. This is not a situation where you have some outside entity acting. This right now, this time, and throughout the last 75 years, the strong voices for Palestine are Palestinians. I have been really fortunate myself to visit the West Bank many times. I've been able to work with an organization there that coordinates with villages to provide accompaniment for school children and farmers who are being threatened and assaulted by Israeli settlers at outposts and settlements that have been built illegally in between their villages. So I have dear friends who, I mean, I've been traveling there over a period of years, so I've gotten very attached to people and families there, and I'm really grateful for those relationships. Sadly, it probably is partly due to those personal friendships that I find myself in this position now. I would like to think that I'm a person who would react this strongly to the concept of hunger being used as a weapon without a personal connection in some way to those people. But I can't actually prove that to myself. And it may well be that the fact of having been so welcomed and cared for and engaged with by these families over the years is part of what's gotten me here.
Part of my belief is that this kind of horrific violence against people is only acceptable if we don't include them in our circle of we. So it's understandable enough that Palestinians say, oh, Palestinians are being attacked. We have to do something about that. For me, as a Wisconsinite here in the USA, it's a little bit easier not to include someone on outside of a border is not a part of we. But very clearly, having both spent time there, and I think just the way that you're oriented in life, your circle of we is much bigger than the average Americans. How did it get that big?
Actually, I don't understand how it gets that small. It's not like seeing humanity as only people who have some particular thing in common with you, looks or the way they make a living or religion or what have you, right? Like, I don't actually think that we're born with such a narrow view. I think that various things in our lives push us that way or encourage us to embrace that. And I honestly don't know why we're so vulnerable to that. But in the case of Palestinians, one thing to keep in mind is that this is not entirely accidental, that Israel spends an enormous amount of money and time and talent, probably spends some of those dollars that we send there, crafting a narrative that assures that they are seen as the victim. They are seen as having this absolute right to use starvation as a weapon. Like, they have invested an enormous amount in forming opinions held in the U.S. about them. And I think that the elephant in the room there is the extremely destructive anti-Arab racism that's embraced by that narrative and which seems to be something that we fail to push back against. So maybe that's part of why. I mean, I don't know, honestly, when people look at images of Palestinian children struggling to get a pot full of food, I mean, why aren't our hearts not breaking? I don't understand that, to be honest. But I also think that it's not accidental. It's not just individual personal failure to see ourselves in others. I think that in this case, that we need to make an extra effort to see ourselves in other people because there is an agenda that's pushing back against that.
Even though I think it's wrong to not see them as us, I do think it's very human. I mean, it happens all over the world, whether it's Japanese and Koreans, or I lived in West Africa in Togo, and the tribe that I was at had opinions about other tribes that are just 100 miles away. And so I've seen it happen all over the world. It's not unusual, and I think it's wrong. And so my point of view on this is that you have to do things to connect people. So I really appreciate the fact that Madison has this Rafa sister city set up with it. I think that those kind of steps increase it. Do you disseminate the information when you go abroad? Do you disseminate it back in Wisconsin so other people are learning about the people over there, that we're really the one people that we have their shared concerns for well-being?
I mean, I think that I wind up in conversations that I wouldn't have if it wasn't for that. I mean, I work in the building trade, so I see a big variety of people in the course of just normal work, right? And they are varied in their news consumption and their political beliefs and their, like, in every which way, you know. But I wind up talking to people about those experiences because they've affected my work schedule, I guess, you know, because I've delayed projects or I've taken jobs or not taken jobs based on that travel. And so it's not that I intentionally make this huge effort to make everybody listen to these stories, right? But they do come up. And I think, yeah, I mean, I guess that people kind of like hearing about an experience someone else has had that's a little bit out of the ordinary.
I was partly wondering if there's a Cassandra Dixon newsletter or something that goes out. Or I'm also curious, obviously, we're featuring you here on Northern Spirit Radio, our Spirit in Action program, which goes out to some 35 stations nationwide. So there are at least some news venues that will disseminate the information about what you're doing, about the flotilla. Is it your experience that other media in Wisconsin are willing to share your experiences, your news, your insight, your caring, your actions to help someone else in the world?
Yeah, I guess is that a question that there's, of course, yes, right. I think people with another personality than mine would probably be taking more advantage of that, I guess. I don't particularly like public speaking, or, I mean, I find it a little bit embarrassing, I guess, to be sort of a focal point like that. It also is frustrating to me that it seems that the way into thinking about or talking about or covering any of this as news is through some interesting random white lady in Wisconsin, right? Like, I am actually not the news story. I'm not the interesting thing that's happening here. I'm not the important thing. And my engaging with it is not what matters. The news story is the death of more than 30,000 people in an area 7 miles by 25 miles in a matter of months.
Amongst my travels, I was to Rwanda, and so I visited some of the sites where some of the genocide happened there. So I realized I was traveling amongst people who participated in genocide, who had families lost, and it's hard to believe that people that seem fairly normal when I'm just talking to them could have been connected with that. And I think your experience has been, my experience in traveling mainly in Africa, has been that even people who are supposedly bad people provide some of the most amazing hospitality, much better than the rich people here in the United States provide. Has that been what happened to you? I mean, people with no food still give you their food and they sleep outdoors. I've had that experience in Africa. Is that what it's been like for you when you've been visiting Palestinians?
Well, Palestine is like hospitality is a cultural value in Palestine in a way that I think you'd look far and wide to find a country or a culture that can top Palestine for hospitality. So, yes.
So it has been.
Yeah.
For me, it struck when my wife first visited Africa with me in Kenya, she got brought to tears by the experience because I think that in the United States, we're trained to, you know, I got mine, Jack. I don't really have to give you anything, whereas my experience in other countries, poorer countries, has been whatever I have is ours for everybody who needs it from me.
That's certainly the response that we see now within the U.S. to Palestine, that people in the U.S. who have very little are donating to aid to Palestine, while larger entities here who could make a huge difference and you know, as a country, we've withdrawn funding to the UN during this time. So, yes, we are seeing people who have like a limited number of dollars that they can give away, choose to give some of those toward helping the situation. Madison Rother has been involved with raising money for Middle East Children's Alliance. And so we did a silent auction. We've done several music events, and I know throughout that auction, like the businesses that donated were, you know, small family businesses who donated gift certificates and beautiful items and to the silent auction to raise funding for humanitarian effort for Gaza. So I think that's probably true no matter what, that people who don't have much are often some of the more generous people in the universe.
And if we hang around with them enough, it can, I think, loosen up some of our American trained kind of, I build walls around my property to keep everyone else out. That's such a common thought here in the United States. I don't really understand. I don't really think that most Americans understand that these are not just people who are being killed, starved, in other ways hurt, but these are people who might be the most generous friends that the people in America could find. I don't think I'm overstating it, and that comes from my experience, that I've really learned to open my eyes, certainly since my childhood, about how much the world is, people in the world are much better than we give them credit for. Have you seen Madison Rafa, that connection? Have you seen that transform people? Have you seen people? Because I'm concerned about how we get from, you know, make America great again with disregard to the rest of the world, how we get people from that place, how we can provide a ramp so that the United States can be a better force in the world. Have you seen the transformation happen with anyone?
So one of the things that we're doing is encouraging people to add a fundraising for aid component to family and community events that they may have coming up. We've established a Madison Middle East Children's Alliance page, and people can use that link to add that to a lemonade stand or a graduation party or a birthday party. I think like these chances that we have where we're already gathered as people who know and care about each other, and I mean, maybe opening day, right, at a ballpark or a spring softball game where people are together already and certainly in a spot where they're appreciating the fact that they're together and aware of being lucky to be able to celebrate together. Yeah, so we've had response to that. I think that engaging in humanitarian efforts is one way of helping ourselves to feel less distance from people. That once we decide that, yes, I don't like it that person is starving, and then we decide, yes, I'm going to send, you know, 5% of what I made today to that, to trying to alleviate that, then hopefully the next time we see that person, that starving child portrayed as just a terrorist, that we push back a little bit harder against that and say, but wait a minute, you know, that starving child that, yeah, you may see them as a future terrorist, but I saw that child as a hungry child and I donated money to try to change that. And now I have a connection with that child. I think especially as U.S. citizens, right? Like money's a big deal for us, right? And so buying is kind of literal for us. We spend money on something and then it's ours. And so I think that can work to the good too. So if people are interested in that, you can go to tinyurl.com/MadisonToGaza. And there's information there on, I think the QR code and the donation link are there. And you're really welcome to use that if you're interested in kind of exploring how that feels, I guess, to think that, yeah, we're all out for an evening together and we're, you know, spending $20-$30 a piece, then maybe share that code around and that last cup of coffee that maybe you didn't really need to order, just donate that and see how that goes. And maybe that's a way to build some of that connection.
Absolutely. And just so you know, folks, I will include links to freedomflotilla.org, to madisonruffa.org, so that you can connect with these places. But I imagine such things exist all over the United States, many other cities throughout the United States connecting with Palestinian cities and helping see other people face to face as real people, not just this label of terrorist or enemy or other. It makes such a difference to encounter real people.
Another group of people I've gotten to know over these years is a group of women who sell embroidery. So the traditional embroidery in Palestine is called tatriz, is recognized by UNESCO as a world treasure. It's very, very beautiful and unique embroidery. And it's also a way for women to earn a living in a situation where it's not always easy for them to travel and their unemployment is very high. But through making embroidered items themselves and then managing to get them to the U.S. and sold here, they actually can have some income of their own. So learning about this incredibly beautiful art form from these women has been special and unique to me. And if people are interested in that, PalestinePartners.org is the site where that embroidery is sold of these particular women, this cooperative, and people are welcome to visit that too. And I think, like, for me, I think of, like, one thing we don't think about a whole lot when we think about conflict and occupation and the ways that pressure winds up on people in these situations is we all assume that we have the ability to work, to get a job and earn a living and travel to and from work unimpeded and in one way or another own the tools of our own work. We were able to get a degree or we're able to take care of our resume. In my case, I'm able to own tools. I'm able to transport those tools. And this is terribly disrupted throughout the West Bank. And at this point in Gaza, it's probably non-existent. So it's been meaningful to me to understand more through these women and their families how disrupted that situation is and how the extent to which just the fact that Israel has not allowed Palestine to really have an economy of its own all this time, that they have no ability to import and export on their own, how destructive that is to people's well-being as families and communities. So.
And through no fault of their own, this is something being imposed upon them. It's a kind of an amazing thing. The prejudice is, oh, they don't have anything, that must be because they're lazy, kind of judgment that people can make about one another is so clearly flawed considering the situation in Palestine right now. Let's return to the flotilla. Did you say how many people are likely to be on the ship traveling with you?
Well, it's hundreds. It's multiple boats, passenger ships, and the aid ships themselves. It's a lot of people. And I can only imagine the cat herding aspects of trying to get all of this organized. But they're Turkish ships, and we'll leave from Turkey. And there are aid workers and human rights observers and doctors and all of the types of people that you would expect to be accompanying aid. And a large number of U.S. citizens also who are there as observers and because we desperately want to see this aid arrive.
Are the U.S. citizens that are there also serving the purpose of accompaniment? I mean, there are in war zones frequently, Israelis, people who are somehow allied with the U.S. government, they frequently are a bit reluctant to have Americans killed in the process. Is that one of the functions of the Americans traveling as part of the flotilla?
Well, none of us is hoping to be killed, that's for sure.
Exactly. It's the purpose is to prevent that. And I'm certainly hoping Cassandra Dixon gets back to the U.S.
Yeah,
safe.
I definitely hope to be back here telling you about it in a few weeks. We do ask that people call their elected representatives, their senators and their congresspeople, and ask those people to contact Israel through whatever channels they have available to them as U.S. elected officials, and ask that this aid be allowed in without harm to it or the people accompanying it and without problems, and ask them to respect international law and allow these boats to come in. And I hope that that happens. I hope that this is the moment when Israel says, well, apparently the world thinks that aid needs to come in, so today we'll just let it go in. I mean, I'm not in a spot to understand how those things change on a larger level, but from the bottom up, for sure, if you never try, they never will. So I think that for most of us going, that's our hope, that this is something, and that doing nothing does not alleviate any of that hunger.
Has there been support specifically to free you up to go? I mean, maybe the buildings will build themselves now that we have perfectly good building weather. Maybe someone's stepping in for you. Is there a support organization around you and others going to free you up to make sure you're anchored? Certainly writing to your governmental representatives is one part of, I don't know, a tenuous support that you might get. But is there another group, a committee? In the Quaker world where I live, there's often a support committee to act as support for a person who is going out doing something important.
I guess I do feel supported by friends and family, and also somewhat forgiven by my family. It's doing something like this causes stress to people that you care about, and I'm grateful that people have just been able to accept that, I guess. And I'm fortunate to be involved with Madison Roth's Sister City Project, and I know that there'll be people there will be watching what happens and paying attention. So, yeah, I'm self-employed, and I think, like you talked about, tax resistance, right? And anything like that does sort of cause you to make some long-term changes in your life. Well, I've been spending a month to 3 months in the West Bank for many, 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 many years. And so it's been a long time since I would have been able to have a job that didn't allow for those kind of absences in the first place. So I think that to some extent, I'm fortunate now that those kind of systems in my life are really already in place. And I think that's probably part of how, like you asked, well, what would make you do it, or what would be your thinking around that? And that part of the answer for me is like, why wouldn't I? Because there's really nothing standing in the way of it.
It is very clear that you've chosen to reach out to an area which is very troubled in the world. And when you say why not, there's a million why nots. You know, you could be helping people in Ukraine or starving people around Ethiopia, or there's so much need in the world that somehow the place that we choose to give our energy and our time and our care, it is important to know what calls to you to do that, because I really wish that there were 100,000 other Americans who were led in the same way that you are, and I think things would change.
For me, though, this is not a random choice of which spot in the world to engage in a humanitarian effort, though. This is responsibility as a U.S. taxpayer, and I may not myself pay a whole lot of taxes, but that doesn't change the fact that I live with the enormous benefits and privileges of being a U.S. citizen. And there is no shirking that. There's no getting out from under that privilege. You have it. You don't get to hand that over, right? So I have enormous responsibility for the use of our tax dollars as a whole, not just the few that I pay. And yes, we have some culpability for humanitarian problems in other parts of the world, but it's hard to top our culpability in this situation now. Our ownership of these starving children, we own this. This is ours.
Well, I both admire, support, and again, I wish more people in the world shared the same level of concern and taking responsibility for that which we can influence, which we do influence. I appreciate that so much, Cassandra. Again, folks, I'm going to have links for Freedom Flotilla, for Madison Rafa, for the embroidery connection that Cassandra mentioned to us. I'll include as many links as I can on the NordenspiritRadio.org site. Cassandra, may you go well. May you be back in a few weeks. And may this have brought some degree of help and change to what's happening in the Middle East. May our nation be changed so that we will study war no more and we will in no way support it anymore. Thanks so much, Cassandra, for joining me, especially in this crunch right before you're leaving.
Thank you so much.
And again, all those links on NordenspiritRadio.org, folks. But before you go, I have one more thing to share with you. As we think of Cassandra Dixon among the hundreds of people traveling with the Freedom Flotilla, over 50 years ago, there was a song produced by a young woman, actually a teenager, the Egyptian-born daughter of Palestinian parents. Her name is Zinab Shaath, and Zinab recorded this song, The Urgent Call of Palestine, and the other three songs on a 45 record, a revolutionary act at the time. So I leave you for today's program with the awareness of that urgent call that Cassandra Dixon and others are heeding as part of the Freedom Flotilla. Here is Zinab Shaath and the Urgent Call to Palestine, and we'll see you again next week for Spirit in Action.
Can't you hear the agony of us?
The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song,